Welcome back, guys. Happy Halloween. Next, I'm going to present to you two original stories that I've written for Halloween. The first one is called Talkers, and the second one is called Robert Hall. They weren't zombies. They were our parents, grandparents, and in especially sad cases, our children. Experts disagree as to the cause. Some blame changes in the climate. Others, toxins and preservatives that build up in the human body over time, and still others look to the darker passages of the Bible for an explanation. What they do agree on is that the dead, unless properly cared for, will show signs of life long after the heart stops beating and the brain goes cold. They're called talkers because, well, they talk. Imagine sitting among the crowd at a typical wake. People filter through, view the body, pay their final respects. I can imagine this with great ease, as it happened to me for the first time just a couple of months ago. I was at the funeral of a friend's father. His father and I were not close, but I did spend a good amount of time at his house when my friend and I were little. The line of grieving family and polite friends had ended. The minister was preparing to begin the eulogy, and that's when it happened. My friend's father began to speak to me. "John," he said, "John, help me. I can't move." You see, it's more of a social embarrassment than anything, a faux pas. It shouldn't happen and doesn't happen if the funeral director does his or her job. But like all of us, they have their good days and they have their bad days. The body must be allowed to cool naturally. Any unusual or unnatural heating of the body must be avoided. The embalming process must begin as soon as possible and must, and this is the critical part, must be carried out in a hygienic and thorough manner. "John, John, please help me. I feel strange." My God, was this really happening? Why me? Why out of more than 100 people sitting in the funeral parlor would he choose me to speak to? "John, I itch. I itch, John." I sat in my chair immobile, frozen as the corpse speaking my name. "John, could you get me a glass of water? I'm very thirsty, John." "John, I don't remember ever being this thirsty." His words were slow and slurred, but perfectly understandable. As I understand it, when the body is prepared, the lips are sewn shut. However, the corpse, if not properly prepared, will actually rip those stitches or chew through them in an effort to be heard. At this moment, most people either choose to cremate, which of course avoids the entire problem, or leave the mouth unrestricted, as the struggle can be disturbing. "John," the corpse continued, "I'm very cold." At this point, my friend approached the coffin along with his mother and said, "Dad, it's Tim. It's Timmy, Dad," he began in soft, comforting tones. "Dad, you're dead. You died 2 days ago. Do you remember that, Dad?" The corpse seemed to shift ever so slightly, but this could very well have been my imagination. "Dad, you died 2 days ago at home. We were all there, Dad. I know you think that you're still alive, but you are in your casket, Pop. We are at your funeral. I'm so very sorry about this, Dad." There was a long silence. People shifted in their seats. A few walked out. "Tim, hold my hand," said what was once his father. By this time, we all realized that no one was going to rise from the dead and eat our brains. There was no need to find shelter in the hills or to hone your fighting skills. There was no need to decapitate corpses. No, this was merely something to be endured, ignored if necessary. I remember seeing a rabbit run over by a car when I was a kid. It was gruesome and bloody, but the worst part was how the rabbit continued to kick as it laid there, when we knew it was dead. as it was almost cut in half by the car, but its legs kept trying to run. "It's just nerves, boys," said my friend Tim's dad. Quite ironically, now that I think of it, "it's dead as a doornail. It's just the body dying. Pay it no mind. It will stop soon." And now, 30 years later, here lays Tim's father, twitching himself, his nerves causing him to speak, to ask for water. Was he really thirsty? Did he actually itch? I guess even the experts don't really know. I mean, how could they? Maybe it's like a phantom pain, like when people lose a limb. Or maybe they do itch. Maybe death itches. That was 2 months ago. My mother died last night. In 2 days, we will bury her. My brother and I spent the better part of an hour trying to communicate how absolutely essential it was that my mother's embalming be carried out properly. It's one thing to have a friend's father speak to me, but my own mother, I don't know that I could take that. The funeral director, a paunchy man of 70 wearing a shiny suit that smelled of flowers and sweat, sat across from us. "Son," he said, "we will do everything we can. We adhere to the highest of standards. We haven't had a talker now for almost a month, and I believe in that case it was due to the fact that the body laid there in the sun for over an hour after an automobile accident. Sorry to be so graphic at a time like this, boys. Forgive me." "Do you think he understands?" I said to my brother as he stared out into nothing. "Do you think he understands how important this is?" My brother took a long, deep breath before speaking. I don't know, John. I'm sure they do their best every time. It's more embarrassing for them than it is for us. It can cost them business. Evidently, some people are just more prone to talking than others. We stood there for a long time. I kept thinking about Tim's father. Did he still itch? This morning was the burial. It was just us, just my brother and me. My mom was quite old, in her 90s. So everyone she knew was dead themselves. There was no funeral per se, no visitation, no friends with casseroles and words of comfort, just two middle-aged men in ill-fitting suits. We stood next to the hearse as they wheeled the casket out of the funeral home. It was cold, bitterly cold, gray and still, as they prepared to move the coffin into the back of the hearse for the drive to the cemetery. I heard it. It was low and faint, but unmistakable. "Damn it," I said. "Damn it," I told them. I told them how important this was. "Take it easy, John. I'm sure they did everything they could. It just happens." We stood silently, listening. From inside the casket, almost too quiet to hear, came a voice. "John," said the corpse. "John, I don't like this dress." "Listen, we have a decision to make here," my brother said. "We can open this casket and watch our mother talk, her eyes closed, her hands folded and icy on her chest, or we can just put this casket in this damn hearse and get this over with. We can lay her to rest and be done with it in half an hour. You can be back in Boston by supper time." I just stood there, feeling the cold in my face, feeling like I wanted to throw up. I hadn't been there for my mom. I knew it. I knew that she knew it. She was a difficult woman to love, but I had just left her alone these last couple of years. It just wasn't convenient for me to be there. Opening that casket wouldn't change that. My mother was gone. She wasn't in that box. I couldn't atone for my sins by carrying on a conversation with 100 pounds of meat that just lay there in a pink dress. "Open it," I said, almost to no one. "John, please," my brother said, putting his hand on my shoulder, "don't do this to yourself. Don't do this to me." "Open it," I repeated. There lay my mother, tiny, withered, dead. "John, I don't want this dress," said the corpse. "I hate this dress." I had to decide at that moment whether to engage. It's still a complete mystery. Do the talkers truly communicate? Do they understand what they are saying, or is it really just reflexes like the rabbit in the middle of the road? "I'm sorry, Mom," I said feebly as my brother threw up his hands in disgust. We did our best to pick out a nice one. There was a long pause, and then a croaking small voice said, "I don't want my hands crossed like this. I want them at my sides." "Mom, it doesn't matter," I said. "We're taking you to the cemetery, Mom. You're dead. You died a couple of days ago. I'm sorry about the dress. I'm sorry about your hands. But in 30 minutes, you'll be in the ground. So please just try to sleep. Just try to sleep. You don't care. You never cared," it said. I watched as the coffin was lowered into the ground. I watched for a long time. It's been 6 months since the funeral. I've done some research. It seems that the average time that a corpse is capable of talking is around 24 hours. Some only talk for a few minutes, but others, it seems horrifically, can still talk for several months after death. They say that if you go to a graveyard in the middle of the night, on a very quiet night, and if you stay perfectly still, you can hear them talking to no one. Robert Hall had lived a life marked by a singular suffocating fear: death. From the moment he was old enough to understand mortality, the specter of death shadowed his every thought. As a child, he would lie awake at night listening to the rhythmic ticking of the clock, each tick a reminder of the relentless march toward his inevitable end. He would panic at hearing and feeling his own heartbeat, knowing that one day he would feel it slow, or even worse, pound right out of his chest. And then he would be no more. Forever. As he grew older, this anxiety evolved into a debilitating phobia, driving him to avoid any situation that hinted at danger, illness, or the fragility of life. Robert's life was very small. Robert meticulously curated his life, surrounding himself with routines that offered the illusion of safety. Robert walked the same path to work every day, chose familiar restaurants, and avoided the news, which was filled with stories of loss and tragedy. Friends drifted away. They didn't understand his constant need for reassurance. He could feel their impatience, their confusion, when he avoided conversations about the future, death being an uninvited guest to any discussion of dreams or ambitions. Years turned into decades. As an old man of 83, Robert found solace in the small comforts of life: a warm cup of tea, the gentle rustle of leaves in the park, and the occasional smile from a stranger. But the fear lingered, an ever-present cloud hanging over him. One crisp autumn afternoon, he decided to take a walk in the park. The air was sharp with the scent of fallen leaves, and the golden hues of the trees reminded him of how beautiful life could be, even as it slipped through his fingers like sand. He settled onto a bench, the weight of his body pressing down into the worn wood, and watched the world go by: the laughter of children, the soft barking of dogs, and the distant chirping of birds. As he sat there, he noticed a man sitting at the opposite end of the bench. He was dressed in a simple black coat, his hair silver and tousled, his eyes a deep, knowing shade of blue. There was something oddly comforting about this man, an aura that made Robert feel as though he could share his deepest fears without judgment. "Beautiful day, isn't it?" the man said, his voice warm and inviting. Robert nodded, unsure of how to respond. It had been years since he had spoken to anyone about anything meaningful, but the man's presence felt disarming, as if the weight of his fears could momentarily lift. "Sometimes I think we get so caught up in the routine of life that we forget to appreciate these moments," the man continued, a gentle smile gracing his lips. "True," Robert replied, surprised at his own willingness to engage, "but it's hard for me. I find it difficult to enjoy life when I'm constantly thinking about death." Robert was surprised at his sudden candor. The man turned toward him fully, his expression thoughtful. "Ah, the great specter that looms over us all. It can be quite burdensome, can't it?" Robert swallowed hard. "It feels like a weight I can never escape. Every tick of the clock feels like a reminder that I'm running out of time. I mostly fear the pain of death, the actual pain. Do you know what I mean? I could have cancer growing inside me right now, or I could fall while alone and die over several days in anguish. The man leaned back against the bench, his gaze fixed on the sky where the clouds danced lazily. You know, fear can be a prison, but it can also be a teacher. It's up to us to decide what lessons we will take from it. Robert pondered this, but how do you escape it? How do I find peace? Sometimes, the man said, his voice low and soothing, embracing the unknown can be the key to freedom. Acceptance of our mortality can open doors to a richer experience of life. Robert felt a strange flicker of hope. Is it really possible to live without fear? The man turned to him, his blue eyes piercing through Robert's veil of anxiety. It is possible, but it requires courage. Courage to face what lies beyond the horizon. For the first time, Robert felt seen. He longed to delve deeper, to unravel the mystery of this man. "Who are you?" he asked, a mixture of curiosity and trepidation in his voice. The man smiled, but there was an otherworldly quality to it. "I'm a guide of sorts, someone who helps others find their way when the time comes." Robert felt a chill run down his spine, but the man's presence was oddly comforting, as though he understood the depths of Robert's despair. "What do you mean by when the time comes? Are you going to hurt me?" The man turned serious, his gaze unwavering. "Every life has its journey, Robert, and every journey must one day come to an end, but that end is not something to fear, it's merely a transition." Panic welled up within Robert. He felt his heart begin to pound and the blood go cold in his veins. There must be some way out of this, he thought. He took a deep breath. "I've spent my entire life fearing that transformation. What if it's painful? What if I'm unprepared?" "Pain is a part of existence," the man replied softly. "Pain is how we learn, but it is also an integral part of understanding joy. Robert, you've missed so many moments worrying about what lies ahead." Tears welled in Robert's eyes. "I don't want to be afraid anymore. I want to feel free. I'm so very tired of being afraid." The man leaned closer, his presence overwhelming yet gentle. "You've done well to seek comfort in the simple joys, but you must also confront the fear that has bound you for so long. Feel the pain. Feel the transition." With those words, the air shifted. The park around them began to fade, the colors swirling into a foggy mist. Robert felt a sense of weightlessness, as if the chains of his fear were slowly unraveling. "What's happening to me?" he asked, panic creeping back into his voice. "Embrace this moment, Robert," the man urged. "It's time for you to let go." Robert felt a strange numbness go through his body. His heart pounded like never before in his life. He felt that he could see it through his chest if he looked down, but he dared not look down. He felt as if he could feel every cell in his body vibrate. The mist became thicker and yet brighter at the same time. As the mist enveloped him, Robert felt an unexpected calm wash over him. Memories flashed before him, the laughter of friends, the beauty of sunrises, the warmth of love. Each moment was a reminder of life's vibrancy, overshadowed by the fear that had consumed him for so long. "Will I see them again?" he asked, his voice trembling. "Life is a cycle, Robert. One that continues beyond what you see. You will not be alone." The mist thickened, and as it enveloped him completely, Robert felt a warmth seep into his being, a sense of belonging that transcended fear. "Who are you?" he whispered, understanding now dawning on him. "I am what you have always feared," the man replied, his voice echoing in the void. "I have been with you since your first breath. I know every moment of your life, but I am also a harbinger of peace, a friend who comes to guide you home." In that moment, Robert let go. With a final long breath, he embraced the unknown, no longer a prisoner of his fear, but a traveler stepping into the unknown. For a moment, all Robert could see and feel was a warm darkness, a void. He began to feel fear creeping back into him, and then Robert Hall opened his eyes, and it was astonishing. Welcome back, guys. DJs, happy Halloween. Be with us tomorrow. We're going to be doing some listener spooky stories. They're really good. I've heard them and very happy to present them. Next is sort of my thoughts and memories of when we went to the Exorcist house back in 2008. Recently met a person who knows the new owners of the house and was talking about getting me back in and just don't think I want to go back there again. So here you go. Here are my thoughts on the Exorcist house. Just to remind you, 2008, no one had been in that house to do any sort of investigation. And there was a guy there named Nick who was living there. And 2 or 3 years in a row, I reached out to him and he just had no interest. And then he started listening to the show and became a fan. And he reached out to us and said, hey, look, if you want to come in and do a Halloween show, that's cool. So we did. And I had been obsessed with the Exorcist story since I was about 12. When I got a horror magazine and they had an article on the movie and they had an artist's rendition of Reagan, the little girl from The Exorcist. I can still see it in my mind right now as I'm telling you this story. And it wasn't a very detailed drawing. It wasn't even a very good drawing, but it captured the horror of her. And so since then, I had just been obsessed. In 2001, I think it was, I was the last person to interview Father Halloran, who was a young seminarian, I believe, and he was part of the crew that did the exorcism back in 1948, 1949 in Bell Nor, this house. And so I was really into this. So I expected when I got to the exorcist house that I would, you know, I would, it would be meaningful. And it was mid-October. Got there probably about 4:30 or 5 p.m., so it was still light outside, thankfully. Made it a little less scary. And I went in, and I went to a bedroom, and it was just a bedroom, kind of a nice bedroom. And then the owner came up to me, and he goes, no, dude, this is my bedroom. The one you're looking for is at the back of the house at the end of the hall. And so I go to the back of the house on the left, and if you want to go look it up, I think we've posted the Exorcist show along with videos, and you can see the whole house. And I was struck by how small this room was. I'm not good at things like this, but 10 by 10 maybe. And it was very dark, dark hardwood, dark windows, dark walls as I remember it. And knowing the story as well as I do, having researched it, I just couldn't believe that there was a bed and a kid and 2 or 3 priests and the dad and the uncle and a dresser and a bookcase, because in this diary, I think a 43-page diary that one of the priests kept, which was the basis of Peter Blatty's book, The Exorcist, they say that, you know, things were flying around and the bed was levitating and the kid was levitating. And the first thing I thought was, oh my God, this room is so vanishingly small. And the staircase, the scariest staircase I've seen in my life, maybe next to the one in my mom and dad's house going to the basement where the butt demon lives. And it was just so narrow. And I just kept picturing, because this went on for months, I just kept picturing, you know, them walking up those stairs, not knowing what they're going to find for that evening. Was it going to be an easy night, or was this kid going to be levitating and speaking in dead languages and stuff? And so I'm up there in the exorcist room by myself. And, but, you know, Katie Cruz was there, Tom Turbrock was there, Tony Colombo was there, Dr. Michael Lynch, a couple of his guys. Father Vohman, who was the priest from The Priest and the Rabbi, was there. Our technical guys were there. So I didn't feel alone. And I hear Tony, not just a voice, it was Tony's voice, say, hey, Dave. And it came from like the right outside the room. You know, when you have a two-story house, you have like the little alcove, for lack of a better term, landing, I guess. And I walk out there, relieved that someone needed me, because I was kind of getting into my own head standing in that room, and Tony's not there. And so, okay, he must have wanted me to look at something downstairs. And so I go to the back window. There's a back window right there, and I look outside, and that's where all the technical stuff was set up, the tables and the equipment and whatnot. And there's Tony. And It would have been impossible. It would have just been impossible for him to pull a prank like that on me. Plus, he knew I would have fought him because I was so afraid of that house. So that happened. And I'm going to say it again, as I've said with all these stories. Could it have been in my head? Sure. I'm in the room where the exorcism took place. I've been afraid of this thing for, 50 years of my life. Could it have been a hallucination? Could it have been? Yes, it could have. But I'm telling you the story all these years later because it just stuck with me so much and it was just so scary. Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. Happy Halloween. So one of the best interviews I've ever done was in my first year, 23-24 years ago, and it was with Father Halloran, who is one of the three priests who actually carried out the exorcism that the exorcist is based on. Sadly, I was the last person to interview him. He passed away a couple days after this interview, and it's absolutely fascinating. Apologize for sort of the not great quality, but it's more than made up for in the content. We are very fortunate to be joined today by Father Walter Halloran, who in 1949 was a young seminarian who assisted his friend and colleague, Father Bowdern, in an exorcism, which later led to the books and movies Possessed and The Exorcist. And we're discussing that with the Father. Please call 969-9797 if you have questions. Father, some of the other things that I think you have said actually happened were some appearances of marks on the body. Some have said were looked like a devil or a bat, and you weren't quite sure. Is that accurate?
Yes. It just appeared to me to be a red splotch.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose if you puzzle over it for a while, you could, try to see something.
Sure.
Like looking at a cloud.
Right, look long enough and you're going to find it.
Yeah.
How about in both the movie Possessed and The Exorcist, the little boy and little girl were levitating. Did you witness that?
No, it didn't take place.
How about the shaking of the bed?
Well, the bed did levitate. It wasn't the case. I read an article or something that it moved because the bed had wheels on it. But I was leaning on the bed myself.
Mm-hmm.
Praying, and the bed came up off the floor and then went down, came up about 8-10 inches and then went back down.
Now, was this something that happened over and over or just one instance?
The only time that I know was when the time it occurred when I was there, and I don't think that it happened again.
Mm-hmm. Father, where did this the exorcisms actually occur? In St. Louis?
In St. Louis, yes, and various places in St. Louis was carried on. The mm-hmm. old Election Brothers Hospital and the rectory of the College Church, which is, there's a new rectory there now.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the home of the aunt and uncle of the little boy. And I can't remember exactly where it was.
Mm-hmm.
North and west someplace.
Right, I had read that myself. Father, how did this affect your personal beliefs? Did this bolster your faith in God? Did it affect it in any way?
Oh, I don't think it made any difference with regard to, my belief in God. I think it affected me in this way that, I had a practical experience of mm-hmm. the existence or operation of evil
mm-hmm.
in my life. I suppose that concept became more strongly realized by me.
Anything happened to you after this? Any residuals from this? Any strange happenings or feelings or such?
No. I sometimes I'd wonder, why was I the one that was picked to be in this particular situation,
mm-hmm.
which I never got any direct answers about.
I wouldn't think so.
But I didn't suffer any physical or mental or mm-hmm. spiritual problems.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phone lines.
Hi, I just wanted to know if the Father knew whatever became of the little boy.
Okay.
He graduated from college, and I forget just which field he worked in. He's married and had a family. I think it was 3 or 4 children. And I actually don't know where he lives at present. I think that he might be retired.
Mm-hmm. I read that Father Bowdern actually performed his wedding ceremony.
Yeah, he was. Father Bowdern maintained a relationship with him for a long time.
Father, were you present when the demon supposedly left, when the exorcism was concluded? Were you there?
No, I wasn't there.
Okay.
I had been taken off the case about a week before this happened.
And how long did this last from beginning to end?
As I recall, it was about 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, I was there from the start, and I think it was about 10 days or so, my superior told me to drop it.
Father, was this the sort of thing, did you feel, it's always portrayed as this epic battle between good and evil and God and Satan. Did you feel at the time it was going on that it was this struggle, or is it more of a, we have a certain number of hoops to jump through and we're going to get through this thing?
Well, it was more of a, periodically you'd get kind of a deep, well, not depressed, I guess, about it, because it looked as though things were going very well.
Mm-hmm.
And then in an hour or so, you'd get a call to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, the sense of struggle, or a battle, at least to me, that wasn't really present.
Mm-hmm.
Because mostly what you were doing, or exactly what you were doing, was you just kind of an in-between. You were exercising or doing the things that are directed by the church to do. And, I didn't feel that I had any special great strength or anything that would bring it to a quick and a happy ending.
Father, when you said that the little boy would speak in this guttural voice that still sounded like a little boy speaking deeply, what was he saying? What sort of things did the quote-unquote demon, was it a back and forth?
No. Sometimes he'd be answering questions that appear in the prayer of exorcism. Like one of the questions is, what is your name?
Mm-hmm.
Or at what time will you depart from this person? And he'd make answers like never, or let's see, or just laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of them, I'm not so clear on this now, but one time I think he said, I'll never leave until the word is said.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about the only direct answer or statement
mm-hmm.
that was given. Many times it would be just laughter on his part.
And Father, did you have the feeling as it was going on that you were hearing from the demon, a demon?
Well, my reaction was that I was hearing what the evil spirit wanted him to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know. There wasn't any change, as far as I'm concerned, there wasn't any change of voice or anything like that.
Okay. Would it go back and forth? Would he be completely normal, the little boy, and then lapse into these episodes?
Mm-hmm. And the changes would be immediate. You know, I'd be sitting there talking to him, and all of a sudden he'd go into, named it kind of a seizure, you know,
mm-hmm.
thrashing about and that sort of thing. And then he'd just as rapidly would change from that. And most of the time when he changed from, you know, acting in a possessed manner, he was kind of mystified or
mm-hmm.
because he didn't had he had no recollection, no recall of anything that had happened just previously.
Well, Father, thank you. Thank you. Thanks so very much for being with us today. I really enjoyed it. Very interesting. And good luck to you.
Well, thanks very much.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.